On this week's 51%, we look at women in music. From a young musician praised for her lyrics, vocals, and willingness to experiment,
I will never be a young bride,
to a veteran country star who's taking it on the road. Plus, we hear from a woman who plays the drums in a republic where it's men who usually pick up the sticks. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I don't need a man. No, I don't need no one. But I think I want him. I want him. 'Cause I know that I.
Percent's Ian Pickus introduces us to a woman who began writing songs at the age of 14, performing her first original piece at a high school composition concert in her hometown of Darien, Connecticut, in 2007.
We're going to introduce you to someone new now, musician Sarah McGowan, whose debut album, For Whom They Sing, is out now.
Right. You gave me love, you gave me life. I was a girl, you gave me life. Under your touch, I grew up tame. But now our love is not the same.
The 10 songs on this album span earnest folk, cheeky anthems, and indie pop, to name a few. It's a pretty fun album. Was it as fun to make as it sounds?
Yeah, you know, I had a really great time writing all the songs and recording them. I tried to make every song on the album different, so I experimented a lot with different genres and instruments, and I had a lot of my musician friends play on the songs as well, so that was a lot of fun.
How many songs did you have in the running to be on the album? Because I'm sure you had to whittle it down a bit.
Yeah, well, I thought that's like a pretty clear choice to choose those 10. So it wasn't really, really difficult to narrow it down.
So let's back up a bit. How did you get into music in the first place?
I began writing songs when I was 14 years old for a school project. And then I continued on from there. And I attended New York University in 2010 to 2014. And I was able to continue my career there and continue songwriting and studying production. And I've just been in the business ever since.
What was the school project?
It's actually kind of funny. It was for kind of a gifted and talented program. We had to choose one thing to study for the whole year. So I chose learning how to write songs and play guitar and perform.
And do you remember the first song you wrote?
Oh, God. I think it was called 2 Months Behind.
And what was it about?
I think the general idea of the song was that I always feel like my life is a little bit on a delay. Like, I think that it's 2 months later than it actually is. So, I don't know. In my 14-year-old mind, I thought that was, like, super profound, and I wrote my song about that.
Do you still play it ever?
No. God, no.
You said that the project of learning to play guitar and you know, become a musician was a year-long school thing. Was a year long enough that you got pretty good at it?
You know, I just barely scraped the surface that first year. I mean, I got over my crippling fear of performing, which was good. So I didn't pass out at future performances. But God, it took me like at least 8 years.
Now, I read when you were at NYU, you originally were thinking about pre-med and not music. Is that right?
When I was in high school, I was part of this all high school student run emergency medical services. So I was an EMT and an ambulance driver while I was in high school. And I really thought that that was what I was going to pursue in my life. I thought I was going to become a doctor. And when I was in high school, I did an internship at a hospital in the surgical department. And I realized that if I was going to pursue medicine, it was going to be my entire life. There's just no way you can actually pursue a full music career on the side. So I thought that if I were to become a doctor, there'd be a part of me that would die inside. So I decided just to go for the music, and definitely went in the opposite direction of a respectable medical degree.
Did anybody try to talk you out of that decision?
No, actually. My parents were weirdly supportive, and they still are, like, very weirdly supportive of my whole dream and my goal. So, and it's a great thing, and I know I'm super fortunate to have, you know, family and friends that are supportive of my music career.
So I guess this is probably something that you started learning in college, and you co-produced the album. Can you talk a bit about what kind of sounds you wanted to bring to the recording process and how you kind of, you know, conceptualized what you were trying to do?
I went into this album really wanting every song to sound unique. I'm definitely afraid of becoming one of those artists who have beautiful music, but every song is kind of like indistinguishable from the others. So I went in and I aimed for each track to have something quirky about it. Either it's a quirky instrument or it's some kind of quirky lyrics or style. Since I was the co-producer on the album, I was able to do a lot of this stuff, like bring in my projects to the studio pretty decently finished.
What are some of your influences? You know, what kind of music do you listen to, and, you know, what kind of sounds were you calling back to on the album?
I'm really inspired by singer-songwriters from the 60s and 70s. So Joni Mitchell is my idol. I love Joan Baez. A lot of the songs I kind of harken back to that folk song soul. But I also like to play around with a lot of different styles. So in one of the songs, I kind of decided to channel Ronnie Ronette. Some of them, you know, I kind of tried to do like an Elliott Smith / Dolly Parton vibe. And, you know, my interests kind of like run the gamut.
I also read that you had something of a Taylor Swift phase.
Yes. So, you know, I started writing songs when I was 14. That was like in the golden age of like Taylor Swift as, you know, teenagers' like ultimate goal. You know, like everybody loved Taylor Swift and everybody still does. But I was definitely going through that sweet songwriter phase of writing about boys and, you know, all this like cute stuff. And I did outgrow that a bit, although I still, you know, obviously write about men because it's the eternal question.
I also read that you have spent some time in South America. I read that. Then I listened to your album and I was trying to see if I could, you know, if I could hear those influences. But did your time there influence the kind of music you made when you came back?
I didn't specifically put anything on this album that was from my time in South America. I always wanted to add a charango. It's kind of like it's a stringed instrument, a little bit like a mandolin. I wanted to add that to some of the songs, but it never really seemed appropriate. So it didn't directly influence this album in terms of like the musical instruments and the instrumentation. But it did give me a better knowledge and a bigger picture of the music world. And I hope that my next album, I'll be able to bring in some of those ideas.
Are you already working on the next one?
Yeah, I mean, I'm starting to write some songs for it.
So how many instruments do you play?
Well, I mainly play guitar, and then I kind of dabble in other stringed instruments. So, you know, I kind of play ukulele and a little bit of basic mandolin. I also play basically right-handed keyboard, mainly for songwriting. So guitar and voice are my main instruments.
Tell me about the song Full Moon Kids. It's fun. It's also kind of haunting. Who are the Full Moon Kids?
I wrote Full Moon Kids on this night, I think it was like two summers ago, when there was a super moon. So the moon was really big. I went for a walk outside, and I came back full of this idea of, you know, all the weird stuff that happens when there's a full moon. People go a little bit crazy. You know, supposedly like mechanical stuff's supposed to go wrong. So I came back with this idea of, you know, a night where all the weirdos and the outcasts and people who feel like they don't belong can come out and be themselves. And I did write it a little bit with like werewolves in mind, but not anything weird like Twilight-esque. Like, it was just kind of, you know, the full moon idea. And after I wrote it, I realized that it could be a really positive song for the LGBT community about feeling like they can, you know, everybody can come out and be themselves.
Full moon kids are coming out tonight.
also make social comment in the last song on the album, Young Bride, singing that you'll never be a young bride. Tell me about that one.
Yeah, that's probably my most melodramatic tune on the album. But basically, the idea came about after looking on Facebook, and I feel like every single day I'm bombarded with posts about people getting engaged and married. And I mean, I'm only 23 and I don't feel anywhere near ready to get married. I'm still very immature, I feel like, at heart. So I wrote this song basically like in response to what I was seeing and what I was experiencing with people around my own age. Oh, will he wait till I'm old? I will never be a young bride. You know, that's pretty harsh, but it's not really a sad song. It's more just a kind of like a bittersweet reflection.
How have audiences been taking it?
I think people have thought that it's like, it's pretty dark. They're like, I'm so sorry that you feel this way. But I mean, honestly, it's not a sad song. I'm not sad that I am not going to be a young bride. Yeah, I pretty much missed the boat on that one already.
Okay, Williamsburg boy. Now, we hear a lot about Williamsburg and hipsters and how all the young people are moving there to make it happen for themselves. This song is very funny. How did you come up with this one?
So this song actually came to me one day when I was on the subway. And I was thinking about, at the time, my ex-boyfriend who lives in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. So I started to write a song about him saying, I'm in love with a Williamsburg boy. And when I got home and I continued writing it, I realized that it wasn't going to be about him at this point. It was going to be kind of a joke song, and all these like goofy lyrics kind of started flowing out of me. And it basically became a satire of that, you know, that Brooklyn guy, that guy that we kind of all know, that, you know, the guy with the handlebar mustache and, you know, he makes his own beer and furniture or whatever. Thought it was totally weird. I played it at a gig and people started freaking out, so I realized that, yeah, I guess people can relate to this and respond to it.
I want to ask you a bit about life as a professional musician. You know, you're relatively new to the industry, even though you've been writing songs for a long time. It's a time where, you know, people don't really buy records anymore too much, and I just wonder how you know, now that you've released your album and you've got some dates and things like that, like, how do you make a career of it in 2016?
It is hard. It's definitely a different world out there with, you know, people not paying for music anymore. For me, it's kind of all about exposure. I still sometimes give away my songs for free, or, you know, I have them on Spotify. You don't make very much money out of them, but I mean, it's all about exposure for young artists, and the social media aspect is really important. So I make sure that I can, you know, post as many things as possible. I'm trying to post some cover songs on YouTube. So those will get me, you know, some good hits. But it's hard. It's all about like trying to distinguish yourself in this literal like internet sea of all these young artists that are out there.
Did you start out doing a lot of covers?
I did, yeah. I had a lot of covers on YouTube. Those are all private now because they were kind of embarrassing. But I think I might bring back a few covers. I might start recording some new ones with some friends.
Well, I mean, I have to ask, embarrassing how? Can you give us some examples?
Oh, God. Well, you know, Taylor Swift was in there. She was definitely in
naturally
there. I mean, they weren't too bad. I mean, I did this cover of Hallelujah, Leonard Cohen's song, more in the style of like Jeff Buckley, the one that everybody knows. And yeah, you know, all my high school friends still talk about it, but I'm just totally embarrassed to even like break that out again because it's kind of become like a joke.
was 51%'s Ian Pickus speaking with musician Sarah McGowan. Her debut album is For Whom They Sing. We transition from a relatively new musician on the scene to a veteran. Dolly Parton, one of country music's all-time superstars, is launching her first major tour in more than 25 years. The first leg kicks off in North Carolina June 3rd, and as 51%'s Jim Lavoulis tells us, includes stops in Massachusetts and New York.
Parton recently announced 14 stops of her 60-city Pure and Simple tour, which coincides with the summer release of a double-disc album featuring new songs and top hits. The 70-year-old Parton was asked on a conference call how she stays so young.
Good doctors, good lighting, and good makeup.
As previously announced, Parton is scheduled to perform at Tanglewood in Lenox June 17th, along with stops in Queens and Lewiston, New York. For 51%, I'm Jim Lavoulis.
Parton is a member of the Country Music Hall of Fame and has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. She also had 25 songs reach number one on the Billboard country charts. One was Jolene. And Sarah McGowan has a song from her first EP of original songs that has been called a modern-day Jolene, a song called Molly. Huguette Tolinga started to play the drums when she was just 7 years old, against the wishes of her family. Drums in Kinshasa are widely considered the domain of boys and men. Her dream is one day to open a music school in Africa, and we get this story from DW correspondent Thomas Klein, presented by Sarah Steffen.
Huguette Tolinga loves music more than anything, but above all, she loves her drums. For 15 years, the 22-year-old has been practicing and playing drums whenever and wherever she goes.
When I'm on stage, it's like I'm up somewhere, but in the end, I find myself still on the ground.
The percussionist lives in Kalamu district, where she rehearses with her band, Hugembo. Congo, women are not allowed to play drums, so Tolinga had to learn everything on her own.
At first, it was really difficult. It was not easy till my family accepted what I'm doing here.
Huguette Tolinga has now gained acceptance. She is admired by her family as well as male musicians. Her band members are equally proud of her.
Normally, I play with men. Huguette, for me, is different from other women. I find her simply great.
It's amazing. Strange, but amazing. For me, this girl is extraordinary.
André Yoka is a researcher at the National Institute of Arts. The professor of music says that the drum is sacred for the Congolese people. It is a kind of a fetish, just like the woman. This makes it difficult for women to play drums.
La femme est fétiche quand vous allez à la guerre.
A woman is a fetish. When you go to war, do not touch a woman. When you go fishing or hunting, you don't touch a woman. If you touch the woman, you lose. Thus, a woman is also a sacred object, and two sacred objects cannot be together.
Donc deux objets tabous ne peuvent pas être ensemble.
But Huguette Tolinga is not about to give up her dream. She encourages other women to do the same. Huguette Tolinga is now well known in Kinshasa. But she still has problems. She has been looking for a producer to support her, but in vain. Nevertheless, Tolinga keeps going on.
One day, I'll open up a cultural center to train artists.
For me?
Huguette Tolinga is a role model for many girls. Now she wants to get to the top and become a big star in Congo.
That was Sarah Steffen presenting the piece from Deutsche Welle correspondent Thomas Klein. A new study suggests musical games with their parents could not only boost babies' musical development, but could help them recognize speech patterns as well.
The Musical Infant. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is Science Update. 9-month-old babies who listened to waltz music with their parents, moving and banging drums, were later better at recognizing musical patterns and speech than babies who played with their parents without music. This according to University of Washington speech scientist Patricia Kuhl and her colleagues, reporting in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. She says brain scans showed that the babies in the music group could track sound patterns the other babies couldn't.
We think that the babies in music intervention improved on pattern perception quite generally, and that this is a good effect not only for music and not only for speech, but probably quite broadly.
She says other studies showed that it's not just the music itself, it's the active musical engagement with adults that triggers the boost in performance. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.
And it's not musical, but music to many ears, especially to a Massachusetts fifth grader who has a special reason to celebrate the announcement African-American abolitionist Harriet Tubman will be featured on the $20 bill. She wrote to President Barack Obama in 2014 suggesting a woman be put on U.S. currency, and she offered a list of possible names, including Tubman's. The girl is Sophia, whose family asks her full name not be used. She tells the Associated Press she was ecstatic to get the news in a phone call from U.S. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew on her 11th birthday. Sophia says she asked Obama in the letter why there were no women on U.S. currency. Tubman escaped from slavery and later helped other slaves gain freedom. Sophia says Tubman risked her life to save others. The choice to replace Andrew Jackson with Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill is being praised for its symbolism. Many say it's a powerful change that a slave-owning president who forced Native Americans from their lands is being succeeded by an African-American abolitionist who risked her life to free others. They celebrate him for his role as a general during the War of 1812 and for his life as a self-made everyday man who reached the pinnacle of power. Meanwhile, a proposal to turn Tubman's upstate New York home into a National Historic Park is moving ahead days after it was announced that the abolitionist would be featured on the $20 bill. The Citizen newspaper in Auburn, New York, reports that U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch signed a general agreement that allows the transfer of land to the National Park Service. New York U.S. Senators Charles Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand hailed the signing of the agreement, which came 2 days after the U.S. Treasury announced Tubman would be on the $20 bill. The agreement must be signed by the current owners of the land and go to the New York State Attorney General's office for review. Schumer said the park could be open by the end of the year. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. Percent is spelled out. This week's show is number 1398.